You're listening to the Airline Pilot Guy Show with Captain Jeff.
Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 98. Hello, you're listening to the Airline Pilot Guy Show, the view from my side of the cockpit door. I'm Captain Jeff, your host, broadcasting live from Studio 301 in the DoubleTree Hotel in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. In this episode, a Virgin A330 lands on a flooded runway. A Mozambique Airlines captain intentionally crashed the airplane, investigators think. More news and feedback. So, get all settled in, tray tables and seat backs in their upright and locked positions, electronic devices powered on, Flight 98 is ready for pushback. Okay, it's been a while, right? I didn't get a podcast out last week. I had hoped to, but I was so busy with the Christmas holidays and my birthday and my daughter's birthday. A lot of things happening at the Nielsen household over the holidays. I just didn't have the time to do it. So I'm back in my normal studio, a hotel room somewhere in the domestic system of Acme Airlines. This time I'm in Palm Beach, Florida, actually Palm Beach Gardens. We fly into West Palm Beach International, and then we drive up 95 a ways. Excuse me. And let me get you caught up on what has been happening. As I mentioned, had a great vacation from just before Thanksgiving and all the way through Christmas and my birthday, which is the day after Christmas. I just turned 55. And then, let's see, my daughter, my youngest, Natalie, she turned 17, and her birthday is the New Year's Eve. It's not, the 31st is not New Year's Eve at our house. It's Natalie's birthday. And it was great having the family at home. My son is going back to college, I think, this weekend. He goes to UCF, and by the way, they played in their first ever BCS bowl game, and they won against Baylor, like 52-42 or something. I watched as much as I could of the game. I got to about the first half, or the halftime, before I had to go to bed because I had to get up early. And so, let's see. I did fly a two-day trip. I picked up a two-day trip between my birthday and my daughter's birthday. And something interesting happened on it. Well, first of all, the weather was just not very good. A way to kind of get thrown into the fire, so to speak, after being off for several weeks. And then we ended up laying over in Fort Myers, actually a place called Coconut Point, south of the Fort Myers, or the Southwest Florida International Airport. And the next day we left there early in the morning, headed up to LaGuardia. And about two-thirds of the way through the flight, maybe just a little bit more than a half, as always, I listened to the interphone channel and the intercom channel, and I also listened to the PA channel, and sometimes that's the first indication that something is going on in the back of the airplane. And sure enough, I hear this announcement by one of the flight attendants: are there any medical professionals on board? And I looked over at my co-pilot, and I said, uh-oh. And he goes, what? Apparently, he wasn't, you know, listening to the public address channel on his box over on his side. And I said, I think we have some kind of a medical issue going on in the back. And he goes, oh, okay. And then all of a sudden, I get the ding, you know, like they want to talk to me. And so I told the first officer that he had the airplane, he had the radios, and that I was going to be communicating with the flight attendants in the back. He said, we have a gentleman who is an elderly man, about 69 years old, male, obviously a man, male, and he is unconscious. And I look down to see where we are. We're just past Richmond, Virginia. And I said, okay, if you'll give me as many of the vital signs as you can and any information that you have on this gentleman and fill out the medical assistance form, and give that to me, and in the meantime, I'll call up my dispatcher and get our contracted medical doctor referral service over the radio. And so I did that and talked to the doctor at our contracted medical service. And after I gave him the information about what was happening, apparently they got the guy back into kind of semi-consciousness, not full awareness and consciousness, but he wasn't unconscious. They were administering first aid. They were giving him oxygen, etc. And the determination was made by the doctors with whom we contract with that since we were as far as we were and as close as we were to our destination airport, LaGuardia, that we should continue. And honestly, if we had decided to go anywhere short of that, let's say Philadelphia or something like that, Baltimore, it probably would have taken about as much time to make the descent, you know, lose the altitude and get down and everything. So I think it was a good decision that they recommended and went forward with that. And we declared a medical emergency and then proceeded up to LaGuardia. And then the neat thing was that the LaGuardia Airport was using runway 22 for arrivals and approaches, and they were using runway 31 for departures. And we were coming up from the southwest, and they said, would you prefer the expressway visual, runway 31? And I looked over at the first officer. It was his leg, and he had already briefed the approach for the ILS to runway, or actually the LDA to runway 22. And he goes, yeah, sure, that'd be good. And I said, okay, because I didn't want to force him into doing something that he wasn't mentally prepared to do, because sometimes you can get in trouble if you try to change things at the last minute. And he said, oh, yeah, I'm up for that. So I helped with reprogramming the flight management system, getting all the points in there. And so we landed on runway 31, which is the same runway they were using for takeoffs, but they stopped all activity on the ground, all takeoffs. And then as we landed and rolled out and got off the runway, the most impressive thing about it was that all the traffic on the ground had stopped and were waiting for us to make our way directly to the gate. So we came in from the south, hung a right, then a descending left turn, final approach for the runway 31 expressway visual approach. Landed, pulled off the runway, and just didn't even hardly slow down, and made it to the gate in record time. And if you follow me on Facebook or Twitter, I was talking a little bit about it on that and said, I wish that I got this kind of treatment all the time. That would be great. I would love it. But that is not normal. So the gentleman, we had everybody stay in their seats, and we ended up arriving. We already had a really, really good tailwind, and we were already going to be early, but with the expedited approach medical emergency declaration and accelerated ground movement, or whatever you want to call it, we arrived at the gate probably about 40 minutes before our scheduled arrival time. So even though the passengers kind of had to stay in their seats and allow the emergency medical technicians, the EMTs, come on the airplane and go attend to the passenger and then get him out of his seat and go put him in an aisle chair and then eventually a stretcher. And then they finally said, okay, it's all right for everybody to get off the airplane. And it was still, you know, by that point, 20 to 30 minutes early. So everybody was very impressed with the way the entire crew handled the medical emergency. And so anyway, that was exciting. Oh, by the way, I mentioned that I had mentioned it on social media, and our listener, Josh Chambliss in Nashville, sent me this. Here, let me see if I can find this very quickly. It's the audio, and he did the editing for me. Thank you, Josh. That really saved me a lot of work. He edited out our real call sign. So you'll notice that I'm not using any call signs when you hear my at first you'll hear my first officer's voice, because that was when I was having the communication with the flight attendants in the back. But then I came back on board and said, okay, you still have the airplane, but now I have the radios. And then at that point, you'll hear my voice on the radio. And again, you will not hear our call sign, so it sounds a little bit weird. We do normally use call signs, but Josh bleeped them out, or not bleeped them, he just cut them out. So let's take a listen to this emergency medical declaration and audio. Oh, let's do this instead. All right, Jeffrey, get it right. Here we go.
Approaching 811-8 descending via the Quarry 3, we have information Tango.
2-9-4, you can keep your speed up.
Approaching 811-8 descending via the Quarry 3, we have information Tango.
2-9-4, you can keep your speed up.
2-9-4, we'll keep the speed up.
78,
I'm saying
you have an unconscious
passenger
on board at the
Mel.
Do you have an age limit?
69-year-old male, not unconscious at the moment.
That's my first officer.
He's awake now, and would you like one-way expressway visual to 3-1? Winds are 280 at 15.
Stand by.
That's when we're having the discussion.
We'll take the visual to 3-1. That'll be good.
Roger, and you did declare a medical emergency, is that correct?
Affirmative.
Just want to maintain 7,000. You can proceed direct to, LaGuardia, maintain 7,000, or report the tanks in sight.
Direct LaGuardia down to 7,000, leaving 10,000, or report the tanks in sight.
That's me.
Contact finals, 1-3-4-4-9-er, good day.
34-9, thanks for your help, good day. Medical emergency passing 10-4-7, and we're going to report the tanks when we see them.
New York approach, good morning. Send and maintain 3,000.
Send and maintain 3,000. Tanks in sight.
You are 13 from the tanks, south the tanks, at or above 2,500, could expressway visual, runway 3-1 approach.
Okay, at the tanks, 2,500 feet or above, clear the expressway visual, runway 3-1.
Contact tower 18-7.
Go to tower. Morning Tower, with you on the our head to the tanks, 2,500 feet.
Clear the morning tower, 28013, runway 3-1, good
on. Clear the land, runway 3-1.
Clear the land, runway 3-1, 737-10.
Clear the land, runway 3-1.
Exit at Sierra.
Sierra
Golf to Alpha.
Sierra Golf Alpha.
All right. And that's, he was taking over the radio communications there, because after we make the transition of controls, because he was landing the airplane and doing the rollout, and then I came on the controls, said I had the aircraft, and then that's when he starts talking on the radio. So anyway, it was a happy ending. We got the gentleman to the gate very, very quickly, and I don't know what the outcome was, if he's doing okay or not. We don't normally get a follow-up on any of that kind of thing. So then, of course, we had to fill out all the paperwork and, you know, do the reports and talk to the duty pilot and yada, yada, yada. But I sat around there for a couple hours and then headed back down to, actually, we finished the trip and headed to Atlanta. And then we were finished. Let's see. What else did I want to talk about here? Well, let's do one of my favorite subjects. And that would be this. The Coffee Fund.
I love coffee, I love tea. I love the Java Jive and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the Java and me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup. Boy.
Since our last meeting together, several of you very generously contributed to the Coffee Fund. If you're interested in learning what the Coffee Fund is all about, head over to airlinepilotguy.com and click on the Coffee Fund tab, or just look for a little cup of coffee that says, "Buy me a cup of coffee." And you'll see how to do that if you'd like, and what the heck the Coffee Fund is for. Essentially, it's to help offset some of the costs of doing this podcast, the media servers, web hosting, etc., and helps me, build up some money to improve my equipment. And since the last... Oh, and also, of course, it's for coffee and beer occasionally. But coffee is, as you know, my caffeine delivery system of choice. And without it, it would be a very, very difficult job for me. So coffee keeps me nice and alert. Okay, so since our last episode, looks like Corey Huffer, Gerard Gallagher, Nicholas Flatholm, Lee Morgan, Kevin Stahl, Steve Trumbull, Christopher Foyt, and Jeffrey Shepard all contributed to my coffee fund. Thank you so much, all of you, for contributing. It really helps make this show worthwhile for me. Okay, so, and thank you, the Ink Spots, recorded in 1940. That's the Java Jive. Okay, I'm gonna fade them out just very, very gently, and hopefully I'll remember to turn that knob back up when it's time for me to play another sound effect. Okay. Right now, I'm heading over here and turning that off. Looks like it's already off. Okay. The other thing I wanted to talk about was, so I did that two-day trip. Then my daughter had her birthday, not 4th of July, the New Year's Eve celebration. And yesterday, the 1st of January, I left for a three-day trip, really a two-and-a-half-day trip. The first day was just a deadhead leg to Tampa, Florida. And one of the listeners is, his name is Haig Martirosyan, and he is a wonderful man, a very talented man, world-renowned organist, conductor, composer. Let's see, he's the dean of the College of Arts and Letters at the University of Tampa, so obviously a very learned man, holds all kinds of advanced degrees and all that kind of stuff. But regardless of all that stuff, but you know, it's great, all that stuff, is he's just a wonderful man, a great joy to talk with. He picked me up at the hotel, went over to a place called Boca, a nice little establishment not too far away. And we both had the specials, and I had the staff special. He had the other special, fresh seafood. It was wonderful. I had an IPA, Cigar City, I think, Ybor Brewing or something like that. Local IPA, which is, I've had it before. It's wonderful. But as good as the beer was and as good as the food was, of course, the best thing about the evening was our company, our conversation. And so, fascinating guy. Really, really enjoyed meeting with you, Haig. And look forward to seeing you again sometime in the future. Now, I know that I have several listeners in the Tampa area. I should have tried to arrange some kind of a meetup, and I apologize for not doing that. It was kind of a last-minute thing, and I didn't really think about, you know, coordinating anything like that until it was too late. Yeah, it was the 1st of January. Most of you are probably watching football games anyway, so... yeah, one of these days I'm going to figure this out, maybe get somebody to coordinate my my local meetups and get a little bit more organized with that. You know me, an organization. Not very good. So, again, had a great time meeting with listener Haig Martirosyan, and that is that. Okay, what else? Anything? I'm sure there was something else I wanted to talk about, but I didn't write it down, so... If I don't write it down, I'm not going to remember it. So let's get on with the news. Okay, well, let's see. Remember we talked about the E-190? Is it E-190? Yeah, Embraer 190 in Africa a couple of weeks ago. Just seemingly plunged out of the sky with no warning. Actually, it was November 29th. It was that long ago. Wow. Let's see. The investigation revealed, or the investigators revealed, on the 21st of December, I believe. Let me get this. Let me pull this up. Here we go. On December 21st, 2013, Mozambique's Civil Aviation Authority reported in a press conference. The preliminary report has not yet been released by Namibia's Accident Investigation Commission. That cockpit voice recorder and flight data recorder revealed that the captain was alone on the flight deck. Banging on the flight deck door could be heard on the cockpit voice recorder. The autoflight systems, autothrottle and autopilot, were engaged. There were sounds and clicks consistent with a person knowledgeable of the aircraft systems commanding the engines to idle thrust and selecting the autoflight systems into a descent at 6,000 feet per minute. Numerous warnings and alerts were not responded to. So basically they think that this guy intentionally crashed, basically committed suicide and homicide, I guess. I think he killed everybody that was on board the airplane with him, which is tragic. I mean, anybody taking their own life is tragic, but when you bring down, how many people were on that thing? 27 passengers and 6 crew. Wow. What a senseless loss of life. And a loss of a perfectly good airplane, apparently. No mechanical problems have been revealed. I haven't seen an update since the 21st of December. I checked right before I did this recording. Again, this is the 2nd of January, 2014. Oh, by the way, Happy New Year. It's the new year, 2014. So that's sad. So I was very saddened to read that. So that's our update on that. Let's see. What else can we talk about? You may have heard about this. This is quite embarrassing. The investigation is ongoing, so we don't have any real ideas yet of exactly how this happened. But it was a British Airways Boeing 747-400 performing flight 34 from Johannesburg, South Africa, to London Heathrow in England, with 218 passengers, was taxiing for departure and had been cleared to taxi to holding point runway 3 left via taxiway Bravo, but they missed the turn towards the holding point for runway 03 left and continued on general aviation taxiway Mike. Now, a general aviation taxiway is a very narrow taxiway, but they continued, and again, this is a big airplane, 747. And they continued until the right-hand wing collided with and sliced an office building. Almost sliced the whole top floor off the office building, luckily. There were some injuries, minor injuries, for ground staff in the building. None of the aircraft occupants received any injuries, and the building and aircraft received substantial damage. If you've seen the pictures of this, it's... not a pretty sight, and basically just a little bit beyond the right outboard engine, that wing is just buried into the building, and it's, you know, the wing is just a mess. And let's see, in the article in the Aviation Herald, they have included the airport diagram, and it said that there is a note on the airport diagram. Basically, if you don't know what I mean by an airport diagram, it's the bird's eye view of the layout of the runways and taxiways and designations and buildings and hazards, and sometimes it's just way too many notes to read. It's almost like a novel. Let's see if I can find the note to which Simon was referring. Simon is the guy that does the Aviation Herald in Austria. Let's see, aircraft to exercise caution when taxiing on taxiway Bravo, which they were doing, southbound to the threshold of runway 3 left, due to apron taxi lane Mike extending from taxiway Bravo in a southerly direction. And aircraft with a wingspan of greater than 52 meters, what is that? Basically, I don't know, something more than 160, 170 feet, are not allowed on apron D taxi lane, because, well, you'll end up hitting a building, apparently. So again, they are, they're doing the investigation to figure out why the crew missed the little bend in the road there to continue toward the threshold of three left. But so the good news is that there were just minor injuries in the building and no injuries on the airplane, except perhaps the bruised ego and pocketbook of the pilot crew. All right. I don't know if I want to mention this. A couple episodes of some crazy people in the last couple weeks leading up to the holidays. Men climbing the fence, or a man climbing a fence at Phoenix Airport, running to a plane. And let's see, this is Robert Edward Bump, 49 years old, scaled a roughly 9-foot barbed wire fence, or barbed wire topped fence, at about 5:30 p.m. at Phoenix Sky Harbor, and before running out onto the tarmac and banging on the engine of an arriving Southwest Airlines airplane. He was arrested a few minutes later after another pilot spotted him and alerted the tower. No injuries were reported, and I guess the Southwest airplane had ample, warning to shut down the engines before the man ran up to them, so that he didn't get sucked into them injured in any way. It's apparently, the man is apparently homeless, so perhaps not in his right mind. Let's see. And then on the other side of the country, in Philadelphia, I believe. Let me see, I'm just quickly scanning this. It was in New Jersey, at Newark Liberty Airport. A man was arrested Wednesday after authorities found him on the tarmac of Newark Liberty Airport. It's not clear how Sia Bryant, S-I-Y-A-H, 24 years old, of Jersey City, ended up on the tarmac. A phone number for Bryant, who is charged with trespassing, couldn't be located. So, not really much information about that. They're doing an investigation in both of these cases as to how somebody was able to basically break through the somewhat sophisticated security systems at both of these airports. So that's something to be concerned about, I think. Also, we know that the American Airlines and U.S. Airways are merging, and apparently, that's not what I was going to talk about. I thought I was going to be talking about their new livery, their new paint job, and I guess the employees get to vote on what they want for their new paint job. But this is actually an incident. Remember we talked about toxic air and fume events, and somebody had asked, hey, it only seems like I hear about these on German flights or European flights, and you hardly ever hear about something like this in the United States. And, well, here's one for you. Several American Airlines flight attendants were taken to a hospital in Miami Monday afternoon, and this was December 23rd, I think, when they were overcome by a strong odor. They were aboard flight 281 as it was preparing to take off on a scheduled flight to Los Angeles when the pungent smell entered the cabin. American spokeswoman Andrea Hughley explained that the odor emanated from a leaking cargo bin filled with fish. Passengers were not directly impacted by the fumes, but were forced to return to the terminal. So, an awfully fishy smell. Something doesn't sound right, right? Something sounds fishy. Oh, that must have been horrible. And the flight was delayed for 5 hours to replace the crew, unload the aromatic cargo, and clean things up. But they had to use a lot of cleaning soap to get rid of that smell. Sodium bicarbonate, baking soda, to try to get rid of all the fumes. Oof. I've smelled that before, and it's not pretty. Not pretty at all. Happy anniversary, commercial aviation. Yesterday, in Tampa and St. Petersburg, Florida, right where I was. I wish that I had known about it a little bit earlier. Could have gotten there earlier in the day and maybe participated in some of the ceremonies. Turns out that on January 1st, 1914, a wood and muslin Benoit XIV, 14, flying boat powered by a noisy 6-cylinder 75-horsepower engine took off from St. Petersburg, Florida, with its pilot and one passenger sitting on a small wooden bench exposed to the elements. The rickety plane traveled 18 miles as the crow flies, landing in the Hillsborough River off Tampa, a 23-minute journey at speeds up to 60 miles an hour. Normally, such a trip would take 2 hours on a steamship across Tampa Bay. By the way, the place that this journey ended was just literally, I don't know, maybe not even a mile away. Hague, is that right? Not very far at all from where we were having our dinner last night. Pretty cool. The flight carried a former St. Petersburg mayor who paid $400, which, if you equate that to today's dollars, would be about 9,323 of them. He paid the $400 back in 1914 to take the flight. It was repeated many times over the next 4 months. During the short life of the St. Petersburg-Tampa airboat line, historians estimate that more than 1,200 passengers made the trip without mishap, paying $5 one way, or $116.53 today. And so, anyway, I'll include a link to the article about that. And again, if you follow me on Facebook and Twitter, I tweeted about it as well. And it was a nice article, a nice write-up in the Wall Street Journal Online. Oh, man, this is an odd one. I didn't hear about this at all. Of course, I don't really watch the evening news at all. I catch most of my news online. And mostly what I look at is aviation news. So maybe they did talk about this in the TV world. I don't know. But I don't recall hearing anything about it. There was a Virgin Atlantic Airbus A330-300 performing flight 98 from Tobago, Trinidad and Tobago, to St. Lucia. Or is it Lucia? St. Lucia? Lucia? I don't know. I should have looked that up. One of the Caribbean islands. They were on final approach to St. Lucia. That's it. Now, that sounds right. St. Lucia at about 7:40 local time in the evening and had just received landing clearance when River Petite Rivière du Villefort burst its banks and flooded the airport, reportedly washing the weather station away and setting the runway under mud and water. The aircraft touched down on the flooded runway without warning and managed to come to a stop. No injuries occurred. The aircraft, however, received substantial damage to the landing gear and underside of the fuselage. The onward flight to London Gatwick had to be canceled. Due to the flooding, the airport needed to close for the rest of December 24th and December 25th, but pledged to reopen on December 26th. Apparently, it didn't really open until the 27th. Local media report 8 fatalities and describe catastrophic devastation all around St. Lucia as a result of the heavy rainfalls. More than 6.7 inches or 171 millimeters of rain in a 24-hour period. Flooding and landslides on Holy Eve. Emergency supplies had to be brought in from around the Caribbean island. So there's a picture in here. Again, I'll have the a link to this article from the Aviation Herald, and you can see some of the pictures of the damage of the underside of the Airbus 330, and I'm not sure how they're going to do those repairs. It's going to be a tough one. It's pretty torn up. And then I was reading somewhere, I don't recall now where, but someone was thinking that because of the flood waters washing over the runway, that it may have picked up one of those shipping containers that are loaded on wide bodies. I think they're called UD3s or something like that. And that may have floated into the path of the run of the airplane, and the airplane may have actually run over it, you know, in between the two main gear. And that's why there's so much damage on the undercarriage of the or underside of the airplane. So who knows? Again, they're still trying to figure out what happened there, and they're trying to make those repairs so that the airplane will be back in airworthy condition again. So I thought that was kind of a strange thing. And then finally, you may have heard about this incident in Ethiopia, I guess, or somewhere in Africa. It was an Ethiopian 767-300 at Arusha, and December 18th, that landed on a short runway at the wrong airport and had a runway excursion. And you know what? I'm going to let our new friend and listener, Rick from Miami, report this for us. So let's take a listen. Take it away, Rick.
Hello, Captain Jeff. Rick, hey. From Miami once again. Well, not in Miami right now. Actually, we just flew into Rio de Janeiro this morning after an all-nighter from Miami. I'm at the Sheraton Resort here in Rio, just north or south of Copacabana Beach. I think it's south. I don't know, but in any case, just the view out my window is a tremendous, beautiful sun out here. Just a great place to be. But, well, the reason why I'm leaving my second bit of feedback here with you is because as I plugged in my laptop, well, my tablet, really, I ran out of battery, and started going through the news, through the day's events, this headline came up. Excuse me. Basically, it says, well, I came across it on airliners.net. So anytime there's anything incident or accident related, well, the first thing I do is I go on over to fherald.com, which is, as everybody knows, a very reliable source for information regarding all those incident and accident type events. And, well, so the headline reads, incident, Ethiopian Boeing 763 at Arusha on December 18th, fuel emergency, fuel emergency landing on short runway and runway excursion. It says here that a Boeing 767-300 performing flight ET-815 from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia to Kilimanjaro in Tanzania could not land at the Kilimanjaro airport because there was apparently a disabled light aircraft on the runway. And then it was instructed to enter a holding pattern over the Kilimanjaro NDB. Oh, wow, NDB. They're still using those things over there. This NDB is southwest of the Kilimanjaro Airport and south of the Arusha Airport. It says here that the crew subsequently declared an emergency due to low fuel and diverted to Arusha for a safe landing on runway 27, which is only 5,300 feet long. That is short. It says here that the airplane was able to stop on the 5,300-foot-long runway. However, when it tried to backtrack and taxi, it turned left, and it was unable to stay on the paved runway, and it came to a stop with all gears, gear on soft ground. Sorry, no injuries occurred, and the aircraft received no visible damage. That's a happy ending. Now it says here that as the airplane was holding over the KBNDB southwest of Kilimanjaro, Arusha's runway was visible from the holding with the same orientation as Kilimanjaro runway 927. Well, obviously, the runway at Kilimanjaro Airport being the main international airport, well, I don't know, I've never been there, but it's got the longer runway, 3,600 meters. I guess it doesn't say it here, but I'm thinking by that time the light aircraft vacated the runway and the crew, well, so I'm now reading from the article. It says here, the crew thus obviously believing to land at Kilimanjaro Airport, touchdown at Arusha. Now I'm thinking, I mean, these guys must have been really wanting to get down, running out of fuel. They saw that runway there, same orientation, thought it was the Kilimanjaro Airport and ended up not being Kilimanjaro, and they landed at Arusha. I don't know if this is another case of airport mistaken identity. The good news is that nothing happened. The bad news is that they have a 767 stuck on the grass out there somewhere, and it's going to be kind of interesting to see how they're going to get it back up flying again. Although I believe that, well, I don't know, I assume that if a lightly loaded 767 with full power and a nice headwind would be able to fly out of a short runway. Well, I can tell you, I have my own experience with flying large aircraft into short runways. We used to fly on the 767 to an airport out in southeastern Brazil called Vitória. And this was an event because we used to only go there, I believe it was about once a week. And you could see just people lining the runway and standing at the beginning end of the runway and just to watch us land there. And the interesting part of this runway was that, well, the airport was only 10 feet above sea level, so it was basically sea level. But the runway was only 5,700 feet long, so it's 400 feet longer. 5,700 feet long, exactly. So 400 feet longer than the runway over at Arusha. And we would come in with our max landing weight, 320,000 pounds. And the airplane would stop perfectly, you know. It was a visual approach. Come in, you know, 50 feet, thrust levers to idle, hold the pitch, let that airspeed bleed. 10 feet, pull the nose back, flare it out a little bit. Nice firm touchdown, full reverse thrust, full auto brake, and the plane would stop beautifully. And now, on the 777, we fly to a another Brazilian airport. This one is called Curitiba, and it's further south along the southeastern Brazilian coastline. But this one's up in the mountains, actually, because the runway is up at 3,000 feet. And the runway itself, I believe, is 7,200 feet long. Let me tell you. Yep, it is 7,200 feet long. So now you have a short runway, and you have to take into account the higher altitude of the airports. You know, you've been talking about density, altitude, and true airspeed, and ground speed, and all. And those are all factors that we have to take into account when calculating our landing distance at that airport. It's quite critical. Well, not really quite critical, but it takes a little bit of planning. Because we do fly in there with our max landing weight as well, and on the 777, that's 575,000 pounds, which is a lot. So we do have a couple of restrictions there. It used to be that we couldn't fly there at night. Now that restriction's been lifted. But a few restrictions do remain. One of them, for example, being the fact that the runway cannot be wet. The other one being that you have to have at least Category 1 minima, so 200-foot ceiling. Runway 15, however, has a Cat 2 approach, but we cannot use that. Also, there can't be any deferred items related to the stopping equipment on the aircraft. So, for example, we can't have a deactivated brake. You know, we have 6 wheels per truck. You know, so we have 12 wheels. All those wheels have brakes. Well, we can't have a brake deactivated. So all brakes have to be operative. We can't have, for example, a thrust reverser deactivated, obviously. What else? Oh, the auto brake system and the auto spoiler system have to be all operative. So everything that has to do with stopping the aircraft has to be operative. And the technique's just about the same. You know, come in 50 feet or 60 feet, power to idle, hold that pitch, let the airspeed bleed a little bit at 10 feet, give the yoke a nice yank back, flare it out, nice firm touchdown, and max auto brake, max reverse, make sure the speed brakes are out, the spoilers are out, and the plane stops halfway down the runway. The brakes on the Boeing 777 are amazing. The most powerful brakes that I've ever experienced, actually. Yeah, well, the 777 itself is such a beautiful plane to fly. Everything about it is great. But the brakes on that thing, man, I tell you, those things, you know, they just perform beautifully. But basically, that was my bit of feedback. That's what I wanted to share with you and all your listeners out there. I'm not going to let this drag on for too much longer. I'm going to go on and head downstairs to the pool, grab a nice cold beer, and take in some of that Brazilian sun. Well, that's it from up here. Thanks again, Captain Jeff, for a great job, outstanding job. Always looking forward to the next podcast. And until next time, blue skies, happy landings, and may God always bless you. Thank you, and we'll talk to you soon.
Well, thank you, Rick. And so he put on his bikini and headed down to the beach or the pool or whatever. No, I'm just kidding. Thanks for the feedback, sir, and your reporting on that 767, exactly what I think happened there. The crew got a little nervous about the fact that the small aircraft was basically preventing them from landing at Kilimanjaro. They were holding, and their fuel state was getting lower and lower and lower, and they basically said, okay, go ahead and set up for a visual approach. They, hey, we have the airport in sight. Wrong airport. Unfortunately, they fixated on it, and it's not the first time that that's happened, and it probably will not be the last. And they touched down on this much shorter runway than they were expecting. And they actually stopped, you know, within the distance, remaining distance of the runway. Their mistake was that this runway, obviously a lot narrower than a normal runway width. And when they tried to turn the airplane around at the end of the runway, they ended up, you know, going off the runway. So you mentioned, I don't know how they're going to get that out of there. Well, I have some video footage that somebody at the airport took off. I guess a couple days later, they had some guys come in and fly the airplane out, and it was a huge crowd present at this much smaller runway and airport south of the Kilimanjaro airport. And speaking of your explaining how people lined the runways at those airports that you were talking about in South America, in this video, if you happen to look at it, you'll see a bunch of people very, very close by the runway at, here at Arusha, cheering on the 767 as it made its very short flight from there to Kilimanjaro Airport. And let's listen to the beautiful sound of those 767 engines. It's at the very end of the runway, and just a huge cloud of dust and debris behind it.
767 taking off Arusha. All the best.
Yes, how beautiful indeed. So it was quite an event at the little Arusha airport when they had the unexpected visitor of the Ethiopian 767. So if you want to watch that video, it's kind of fun to watch. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. Okay, let's continue with the show. It's going to be a short show tonight for a couple different reasons. Technical reasons, because I'm running out of recording space and battery power on my electronic devices, and I'm running out of battery power for my brain and my human devices. Well, I don't know what that means, but basically I have to get up really early in the morning. I have a 5:45 departure. Got to get up at, about 3:30. I have a 4:25 pickup. So it's going to be a short night. So I'd love to keep this going for 2 hours, but it's not going to be a two-hour show, and that will make those of you happy who do not like the super long shows. Okay, so let's get on with the best part of the show, your feedback.
Captain, incoming message.
Thank you. Okay. Now, let's see. Who are we going to start with feedback? Let's start with Tom. I didn't get to Tom's feedback on the last show, and he sent me some audio feedback. So let's take a listen.
Hey, Captain Jeff. It's Tom here from Bradenton. I just wanted to let you know I enjoyed listening to your discussion in episode 96 about the old-time rules for keeping to the right when flying along highways or rivers. It reminded me of flying the Hudson River in New York when I was an active private pilot. At that time, the 1980s, there was a VFR corridor along the river, along the New York City skyline, that was a favorite flight of us recreational pilots. It existed between 1,000 and 1,100 feet AGL, course, you couldn't fly below 1,000. And above 1,100 was restricted airspace due to the proximity of both Newark International and LaGuardia airports. Anyway, flying the right side of the Hudson River from the Verrazano Narrows Bridge in a northerly direction put us very close laterally to the twin towers of the World Trade Center, since they were situated very close to the river. The observation deck on the south tower was situated atop the 1,425-foot building, so my passengers and I had to crane our neck upward to watch people pointing to us as we flew by several hundred feet below them and a few hundred feet off our right wingtip. It was also very interesting during the return flight south as we flew directly over both the Ellis Island Immigration Center and the Statue of Liberty. Also of interest was my base airport, Linden, New Jersey, which was located immediately to the southwest of Newark International. As you know, Newark has two parallel north-south runways, and airliners landing to the north pass very close to us in Linden, and just a few hundred feet above the ground on their final approach. Even though the pattern at Linden was designed to avoid encroachment on Newark's airspace, there was little margin for error. Linden had intersecting runways 927 and 1634. Fortunately, we seldom had to land to the west. Anyway, Captain Jeff, your recent episode brought back some very fond memories. Thanks a lot, and keep up the good work. Tom in Bradenton.
Well, thank you, Tom in Bradenton, a beautiful place to live right there, was it north of Sarasota or somewhere in that vicinity? And as I mentioned, I was just down in your neck of the woods, just south of there in Fort Myers, on the 29th. Maybe one of these days we'll have a meetup over there in that area. Okay, again, thanks for the audio feedback, Tom. I'm glad that I was able to kind of bring back some of those memories for you. And here is some audio feedback from First Officer Jake. You know, the hideous one, I think.
Hello, Captain Jeff. It's hideous First Officer Told Jake you. Calling from sunny Fort Lauderdale.
You're hideous.
While on a layover. Actually, make that partly sunny Fort Lauderdale. Mostly cloudy. Anyway, great job on episode number 96.
Thank you.
I'm calling to wish you a happy anniversary, 25th anniversary at Acme Airlines. Looking forward to episode number 97. Hope your vacation is going great.
It is going great. Thank you very much. And yeah, I forgot. Did I mention that? I must have mentioned that. My 25th anniversary in the commercial airline world at Acme Airlines was on December 15th. And let's see, I get a pin, 25-year pin. I need to go into the chief pilot's office and collect it. Anyway, yeah, kind of a milestone, I guess. Thank you very much for those happy wishes, Mr. Jake, you hideous one, you. Okay, Megan writes, I just wanted to let you know that I love your podcasts, and they're always very informational. By the way, Megan, about 90% of the stuff that I say and talk about is probably not even right or true. I make it up. No, I'm just kidding. I don't really intend to make it up. Let's see. I've been listening to your podcast for probably 2 years now, but I just received another contribution to my coffee fund. let's see if I can pull that back up and see who that was. You may have heard that little ding in the background. Anyway, I'll talk about whoever it was that just donated to my coffee fund on the next episode. I do appreciate that. Uh-oh, what did I just do? Darn it. Anyway, keep on going here, Jeff. Let's see. So I started at the beginning. This is Megan talking again. I've been listening to your podcast for probably 2 years now, but I had to start over from where I was at about 2 years ago when my computer died. So I started at the beginning of what was on iTunes, and I'm now on episode 50. By the way, that's interesting. You said at the beginning of what was on iTunes. Are there some of my earlier episodes not available on iTunes? If that's true, then I need to do something about that because they should all be there. Okay. I'm now on episode 50, so only another year's worth to go. I'm sorry, Megan. I listen at work mostly. I'm a young adult finishing my bachelor's degree and working full-time. I'm originally from Oklahoma, but I now live in Northeast Ohio. I've been lucky enough to travel a decent amount both around the country and overseas. I felt obligated to include a question, and it's a bit more of a Catholic pilot one. How do you make it to Mass on non-Sunday holy days of obligation? I know I always have problems with my parish's schedule for Masses for holy days, with my schedule for work and school, and would have to imagine it's even harder for you. Have a great day. Many prayers and blessings for you, your family, and all your listeners. Megan. And it looks like she's at Case Western Reserve University Farm in Hunting Valley, Ohio. Well, thank you, Megan, and good luck on finishing up your bachelor's degree and working full-time. And now, you know, at first I'm thinking, well, I'm not going to answer this question on the Airline Pilot Guy show because it's no longer the Catholic Pilot show. But this applies, doesn't necessarily apply just to we Catholics. I mean, anybody out there listening who has some kind of faith, this could apply to you. You might have special ceremonies, whether it be if you have a Islamic faith, if you have the Jewish faith, etc. There are certain days, holidays, holy days, that you are somewhat obligated to attend the ceremony or the service or whatever you want to call it. We call it Mass in the Catholic Church. And so when you have a kind of a wacky schedule, you're an airline employee or some other kind of employee that works odd hours and odd shifts and travels away from home, how do you do it? Well, one of the nice things about the Catholic Church is that when you have a holy day of obligation, now every Sunday is a holy day of obligation for us, but we have several feast days and other events throughout the year that the church deems important enough to ensure that we attend Mass. And the nice thing about the Catholic Church is that they usually have many, many opportunities, more than just one time on that particular day. They usually have one or two vigil Masses, which means the night before, and then during the holy day of obligation, they usually have, you know, one early in the morning, mid-morning, noon, maybe mid-afternoon. That's not very normal, but maybe a 5 o'clock and then a 7 o'clock. So there are many, you know, opportunities to ensure that you take part in that opportunity, holy day of opportunity. So I haven't found it to be a problem at all because, you know, as much as I fly, Megan, if I fly early in the day, then I'm usually somewhere where I can go to a Mass in the afternoon or evening or vice versa. If I'm flying later in the day, then I can do it in the morning. You know, you get the idea. So that's a great question. And yeah, sometimes it's difficult, but not as difficult as you'd think. And it's a little bit more difficult when I go to smaller towns, the bigger cities. That's never a problem. The smaller locations, sometimes it is. Okay. And thanks for listening, Megan, and good luck with listening to the rest of those podcasts. Han writes, started to listen to your podcast from 93, slowly going backwards. Keeps my brain sane while on solo jobs on the farm. Hey, another farmer out there. Been a commercial airliner fanboy since I can remember. Anyway, I found this video this morning of a behind-the-scenes from Air Tahiti Nui for their 15th birthday. Not sure if your listeners have seen it. And this is something I think somebody else had sent to me through social media, and I kind of retweeted or rebroadcasted or whatever. I think I put it on Facebook. Yeah, I think that's what I did. It was beautiful. You're right. Thank you for sending that, Han, and sending it to my feedback so I can mention it to all the rest of the listeners who may not have seen it in my Facebook post. So again, I'll try to remember to have a link to this YouTube video in the show notes. Really, definitely, it's really worth looking at. Beautiful. Okay, so he says, anyway, I have a question. Back in my younger years, I flew a lot in the F-28-1000 and BAE-146. Since then, the company has upgraded to 717s and the Airbus 320. I have noticed that the rear engine airplanes, when flying through turbulence, all the passengers can feel it compared to the wing-mounted engine. My question is that, is it more easier to control a wing-mounted engine compared to a rear engine plane during turbulence? And second question he has, if you run out of fuel, hope you don't, do you need to bleed the system like a diesel engine, or does it start up like a petrol engine in any commercial jet airliner? Well, Han, thanks for the feedback. And that last question about bleeding the system and all that kind of stuff, I have no idea. Luckily, I've never run an engine dry, and this is probably something that a mechanic would have to answer. So I know that I have mechanics out there. Mechanic Bob, I know you're out there listening, and some others out there that I know who are listening who are mechanics. Perhaps you know the answer to this. And if you do, send me some feedback, and then I can answer Han's question about bleeding the system like a diesel engine. But going back to the turbulence thing, it's interesting that you say that in your experience, it seems like the turbulence is felt by everybody in a high, like a, what is it called, a tail mounted or a, yeah, engines mounted on the tail, T-tail kind of airplane, as opposed to a wing mounted engine airplane. And I almost, my anecdotal experience and evidence is almost the opposite. It seems to me that the T-tail rear engine mounted airplanes are more stable in turbulence than the wing-mounted airplane or wing-mounted engine airplanes. I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy. Don't answer that. So I don't know. I'm not sure why you have that experience. Anybody listening out there have any? I know I have people out there who know a lot about aerodynamics and aeronautics. Perhaps there's some kind of a scientific explanation for that. I don't know. As I said, my experience is like the opposite of yours, Han. So I really don't know how to answer that question. So maybe my airline pilot guy, APG community members will help. Thanks for your feedback, Han. And this was on, it wasn't feedback to my email. It must have been on Facebook. This was sent by Garrett Easley, who is the host of the My Pilot Chronicles podcast and blog. He says, hey, Jeff, Merry Christmas to you and your family. Thank you, Garrett, and to yours as well. And by the way, it is still, let's see, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 1, 2. It's the ninth day of Christmas. So it's perfectly fine to say Merry Christmas right now, by the way. So everybody listening, it's the 2nd of January. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And we have, what, three more days to go, right? 10th, 11th, 12th day of Christmas, and then the Epiphany. Okay, back to your feedback, Garrett. Wanted to chime in on your latest episode and ask a follow-up question to the lost communications question you had. You had discussed all the lost comm procedures that we are supposed to follow, whether in VMC or on IMC, which is visual meteorological conditions or instrument meteorological conditions. I was curious, do you carry a handheld comm transceiver as well? I myself carry a handheld in my flight bag just in case this ever happens. I've not had to use it yet, but would think that if I was ever to lose radio communications, that I could pull out the handheld and at least have some sort of means to get me on the ground safely. I was curious if handheld portable radios were allowed in your operations and if the signal strength would be strong enough to provide a good means of voice communications through all the metal and electronic interference of the larger airliners. It would make sense that a good quality handheld would be a great backup for those scenarios. What say you? And he says, P.S. I find myself singing Java Jive on my way to work in the mornings. Not sure this is a good thing or a bad thing. Ha ha. Happy holidays, Jeff. See you in 2014. Hi, Garrett. I'm in 2014. Are you? Yeah, you know, I've thought the same thing, how it might be kind of a cool, well, not necessarily cool, a handy, safe thing to carry one of those handheld VHF comms transceivers. Never seen anybody that I've flown with that I've known about anyway have, you know, with one. I don't know if they work up at 30-something thousand feet or if they work in airliners. I don't know if there's anything specifically that says that we can't use them, although my company, Acme, definitely has a policy that we are not to use electronic devices in the cockpit. But if this were a situation where we had completely lost communication, all of our comm radios, and we had no other way to communicate, I would certainly dig one up out of my flight bag if I had a VHF comm transceiver thing. I would definitely use it, regardless of the policy. Because, you know, it could mean the difference between a successful outcome and an unsuccessful outcome. I don't know. Listening out there, any airline pilots carry a VHF radio? And if so, does it work? Good question, Garrett. I can see its use and utility on airplanes that fly at lower altitudes. But I don't know. Very, very good question. So if you have an answer to that out there, listeners, send it to me. You know how to do it. feedback@airlinepilotguy.com or on Facebook or Twitter or YouTube or all the different things. Okay. And again, that's Garrett Easley, the host of My Pilot Chronicles podcast. That's mypilotchronicles.com. Okay, how are we doing on time? A little over an hour. Let me make sure that we haven't run out of space on my audio recorder. Looks like I still have about 13 minutes left over here. And, hey, did you see this? Yeah, my wife gave this to me as a little, kind of like a stocking stuffer. Didn't mean to hurt your ears. It's a little flashlight that clips on your baseball cap visor. I was walking around the house in my pilot cap, my pilot hat, with this on the visor, looking like a real geek. Nerd. Probably nerd would be a better way to describe it. But, so, kind of handy. Kind of a goofy gift that my wife gave me. So, comes in handy. I can point it at my digital audio recorder to see how much time I have left. And, anyway, so, keep going, Jeffrey. I'm easily distracted. Let me quickly say, and I forgot to mention it at the very beginning. It was right on my script, and I just forgot completely to, you know, habit patterns. This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, a new partner, a new sponsor of the show. And basically, you can sign up for a trial subscription to Audible.com. by going to audibletrial.com/airlinepilotguy. And that way they know that I referred you to that. And you get a 30-day period of free sampling of the audible.com service and a free audiobook. Here, I'm trying to find the ad copy for this. I know it's here somewhere. I'm just kind of winging it right now. But, come on, Jeff. What's the matter with you? I was going to recommend a book that I haven't listened to myself, but I thought it looked interesting, and it might be something that you could choose for your Audible.com 30-day trial, free trial membership. Again, that's audibletrial.com/airlinepilotguy. And this book is entitled 9 Minutes, 20 Seconds, The Tragedy and Triumph of ASA Flight 529. And you may remember back in, when was that? 1995. 26 passengers and a crew of three aboard a commuter plane in Atlanta headed for Gulfport, Mississippi. Shortly after takeoff from Atlanta, they heard an explosion and some see a mangled engine lodged against the wing. From that moment, 9 minutes and 20 seconds elapse until the crippled plane crashes in a West Georgia hayfield. And the author, Gary Pomerantz, takes listeners deep into the hearts and minds of the people aboard, each of whom prepares in his or her own way for what may come. It was, went backwards on my page. It was not necessarily a completely tragic ending. I think that several people lived in this incident. 19 people survived the crash and the aftermath. Let's hear a little sample from this Audible.com book, 9 Minutes, 20 Seconds, The Tragedy and Triumph of ASA Flight 529.
Metal become the dominant material in the production of airplane propellers, including those used by Charles Lindbergh on his historic transatlantic flight in 1927. Lindbergh's plane's two composite metal duralumin propeller blades were made by the Standard Steel Propeller Company, which through corporate evolution would become Hamilton Standard. By March 19...
Okay, there's a little sample of that Audible book that could be one of your free, or your free selection, when you sign up for Audible.com's 30-day free trial by going to audibletrial.com/airlinepilotguy. And I finally found my little copy. So download your free audiobook today, and you'll see the information about that in the show notes. Okay, now let's continue with Corey. He writes, first of all, great podcast. I don't think you hear that enough, so that I'd help you out with a little morale boost. Thanks, Corey. I think that's tongue-in-cheek. Yeah, it's tongue-in-cheek, too. My name is Corey. I've been an E3 mechanic based at Tinker Air Force Base for the past 15 and a half years. If you ever have any airplane maintenance questions, let me know. Oh, there you go. Previous listener was writing about, Han was asking about jet engines. What happens when you run them dry, when you run them out of fuel? Do you have to bleed something? What do you have to do to a jet engine if you run it out of fuel? If you know the answer to that question, let me know, Corey. Okay, if you have any airplane maintenance questions, let me know, and I may be able to help. I've listened to all of your... By the way, do I have a Southern accent? I was sitting next to a lady yesterday on my deadhead flight to Tampa, and she asked me where I was from, and I said California and Mobile, Alabama. And it goes, oh, yeah, I hear the Southern accent. And I went, Southern accent? Really? Huh. I'd never thought of myself as having a Southern accent, but I've lived most of my life in the South now, so maybe I do. I mean, that's okay. I just didn't think I did. Okay, I've listened to all of your APG. This is back to Corey. I'm on number 95 now, and I've been waiting for a chance to impart some airplane maintenance knowledge to you and your listeners, but it seems like the other listeners have you covered so far. I do have a question for you, though, since you used to fly L-1011s. I only flew on it once or twice that I can remember on the way back from the sandbox many years ago. I've been 8 or 9 times now, so it's hard to remember the salient details of some trips. Anyways, I was on a L-1011 once, and during landing I noticed a red disc, for lack of a better word, that raised up out of the top of the wing. It was toward the wing root, maybe 4 or 5 feet from the fuselage. It's been many years ago now, so I may be remembering wrong, but it seemed like a 2 or 3 inch round disc that extended maybe an inch from the surface of the wing. It seemed to raise just before landing around during the flare, if I remember correctly. I thought it was odd since I'd never seen that before on any other airplane, so when we took off from our stop, I watched and they went back down shortly after takeoff. I've wondered about those stupid little disc things for years, and despite my best Googling efforts and asking everyone I knew that has worked on or near L-1011s, I've come up with nothing. The best I can guess is that they're some type of stall transducer, but those are typically located on the underside of the wing, so I'm at a loss. If you know what I'm talking about and can validate that I didn't dream that up, let me know what they are. So, Corey, are you really in Tinker, or are you in Denver, Colorado? You know, they just passed that marijuana thing. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know if you're imagining that or not. I don't, you know, it's been such a long time since I've flown the L-1011. I don't really remember anything about a red disc or anything. The only thing I can think of is possibly it's some kind of a indicator, a mechanical indicator that pops up above the wing when the main landing gear is down and locked, which it could be a visual indication that if you had some kind of a gear malfunction, that somebody could go over and look out the window and see the red disc viewable or in view, which would mean that, you know, give you the idea that the gear is down and locked. That's my guess. I don't know. I really don't know the answer. So I do have a couple pre-flight little picture spiral-bound little things in my drawer at home. So maybe I'll, if I remember, I'll look at that and see if there's anything about a red disc above the wing. But probably not on the pre-flight thing because we didn't get up above the wing. We're below it. I don't know. If you, if anybody out there knows what the answer is to that question, let me know. He says, I'm also a, this is Corey again, I'm also a private pilot, though I haven't exercised the privileges of my ticket since I earned it back in 2004. I miss flying like crazy, and I intend to get my instrument ATP, COM, etc. rating, commercial ratings next year, and fly full-time once I retire in 4 years. Keep doing the podcast, and we'll keep listening. I wish you many clear skies, tailwinds, and good co-pilots. He says, P.S. Love your new website. I think you should add a FAQ, or I usually say FAQ, section to address the questions that you end up answering over and over and over and over. I added those two. That's a great idea, Corey. Thank you. I'll get to work on that when I get a chance, but you're right. So many times people write in with questions that have been answered in one of the previous 90-something episodes, and if you're a regular listener, you're probably sitting there going, oh, not again. I've heard this darn question and answer so many times, it's making me sick. But so that'd be a great idea to point people to the fact, maybe even make some audio files that I can answer the question so that I don't take up your time on the podcast. So again, great idea, Corey. Thank you. And then he followed up with another email feedback. He said that I posted feedback on your website earlier this evening and remembered that I had another question for you that I forgot to ask. It seems like airline pilots know down to the exact minute what time they take off and land. Is it the job of the pilot not flying to note the times, or does the FMS receive a signal from the squat switches, you know, landing gear switches that let the airplane know when it's in the air or something? Thanks again for your great show, and in case I don't leave feedback before then, congratulations on reaching your 100th episode. I look forward to many more, and no, I don't mind the two-hour format at all. And thank you very much. No, we're not quite there. This is 98, but I appreciate the best wishes for episode 100, which should occur in two more episodes, right? P.S. I didn't mean to insult your intelligence by spelling out the jargon for you, but I've learned that you never know when someone may be unfamiliar with a term that's common to you. I'm sure you've come across that more than once in your line of work and in the military. Yes, you're absolutely right, Corey, and I did not take offense at all. In fact, I do the same thing when I'm talking. I try to, when I use an acronym, I try to, you know, spell out or say what that acronym is. So people will go, oh, that's a... Okay, let's see. Sorry to hit you with three separate emails. He actually added one more. I forgot to mention, if you're ever in the Oklahoma City area, I have heard that you occasionally lay over here, I would be happy to buy you a brew at one of the local pubs. Well, thank you very much, Corey, for all your feedback and your suggestions and all that stuff. Oh, let me answer your question. Yeah, the flight management system computer and the ACARS box and all the sensors like the doors and the beacon, and we have squat switches and all that kind of stuff, and it's one of those squat switches, the weight off the wheels, that registers when we're in the air and when we touch down, that shows us on, and then when we're at the gate and we open a, either set the parking brake or open the door or turn off the beacon or some combination thereof, the system will automatically show us as in. So we have out, off, on, and in, and that's all done automatically with sensors. So nobody has to pay close attention. Now, back in the old days, we did, and it just became a habit pattern. You know, you block out and you write it down. You take off and you make a note of that. And then when you land, you make a note of that. And then, you know, you get the idea. So that's the way it works in the modern airline world. All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and end the show. I have a ton. Kevin Cox, my Southern California Catholic air traffic controller and supervisor, sent me a quick little picture here, and it's a picture of a screen that has Santa Claus in his sleigh with all the reindeer, and he said he sent this to me, one of the aircraft in the ATC simulator. So I guess he was doing some simulator work over the holidays, and instead of an airplane in the picture over the runway, it is Santa Claus in his sleigh with the reindeer and Rudolph with his red nose in the front, and they are perfectly aligned on the center line. Good job, Santa Claus. Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate that. So anyway, we have much, much more from so many of you, and I thank you for that. And if you send me feedback, I just want you to know that I actually read every single bit of feedback that I get. I try to answer as much of it as I can, either by sending you a reply in the email or a reply on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, or through an audio reply like on the show. But sometimes things fall through the crack, and I don't mean them to. I hope that nobody's ever offended if you send me something and I just don't get around to acknowledging it. But I just wanted to let you know that if you send me feedback, I will see it, even if you don't hear anything back from me. So keep sending it in. I do appreciate it. And as I said many, many times, it's not my show. Oh, I just looked down, and guess what? My audio recorder is off, but I hope that my video recorder is still going right now, because I'm going to have to get that audio to continue with my audio podcast. But anyway, I just do appreciate your feedback, and you're as much a part of the show as I am. So thank you for that. So with that, these machines are telling me it's time to go. Just wanted to let you know quickly, I'll be traveling after I get back from my trip tomorrow. On Saturday, I'll be heading to Las Vegas, and I'll be attending the New Media Expo and the Podcast Awards on Sunday evening. Remember that I was nominated, my show was nominated for one of the Podcast Awards. I don't know if I won or not, probably not, but I plan on going anyway and meeting with people and enjoying the fun and frivolity of all the new media world has to offer. So, you know, think about me, and I'll let you know how that all went on the next episode, which hopefully will be sometime next week. So until then, wishing you clear skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Take care, and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.